Over IP, if you want to know more, I have an entire course on voice over IP, and you can take that. But we'll say just a very brief comment in terms of ETSI, the European Telecommunication Standards Institute, which, if you're into standards, is a wonderful place to go. It's located in Sophia Antipolis in the south of France. It's a marvelous spot. However, you'll have to learn ITU-T speak. They have introduced something called the Telecom and Internet Protocol Harmonization over Network, TIFUN, or Typhoon, maybe. And the idea here is to be able to integrate IP networks, which may have their wireless access points or base stations, and something often called a gatekeeper. And this is basically a device to control who's allowed to establish calls through the gateway to the GMSC. And so the result is to integrate together cellular networks with wireless LAN-type networks and using IP backbones. And you can go and read more about this. It's been a very, very, very big effort. The hard problem is that it's been driven by ETSI. And there the problem is ETSI is primarily focused on telecom and didn't know very much about datacom, so they've had a hard time accommodating things. Now, Ericsson introduced something called GSM on the net, and Ole Grunberg wrote a paper about it in Ericsson Review already in 1998. And gee, when we look at that picture, and we go to look at the previous picture, what do we see? It's almost all the things that were subsequently proposed later in Typhon. And it was already implemented and running in 1998. So why weren't they more integrated in the beginning of the 2000s? Well, first of all, does anyone know where GSM on the net was actually first introduced? It was introduced in the U.S., which didn't have a GSM market. And the purpose for introducing GSM on the net was to be able to put GSM base stations inside companies' buildings, yes, to build enterprise GSM systems, right? Because if what you know is GSM, well, what am I going to make next? Well, another GSM system. Right? I'm not going to suddenly go and make a DAMP system or a PACS system or something. I'll make a GSM system. And until they had lots of operators adopting GSM, the easiest way to make and sell more GSM equipment was to put all of this stuff on an IP network, because that's what companies had inside their campuses and buildings. And so GSM was viewed as more like an indoor cordless telephony replacement. Right? A very interesting approach. It wasn't introduced here in Europe for that, but it was introduced in a different market because it didn't have competition there for it. And there's even a proposal for something called IGSM, and it's based on integrating H.323 gateways to GSM. Okay. So now we'll shift gears a lot and talk about prepaid. I mentioned prepaid yesterday. It's the customer pays before using the service. The advantage, the operator's got all the money. There's no risk. Even more importantly, since the operators have all the money in advance, they can actually go and invest it and earn interest on it. The operator says there's no need for credit checking, invoices, collections, etc. The customer doesn't have to have credit worthiness. They don't need to be able to sign a contract. And in Sweden, that was absolutely essential because people under the age of majority can't sign contracts. But they are allowed to spend money. So the result is you get a prepaid subscription, off you go. In lots of countries, there's no tradition of postpaid services. Everything is strictly cash up front. So I grew up in an area where people still buy even entire farms for cash. The prepaid value can be even installed in devices. So a number of years ago, we had some students who built a stuffed bear with a prepaid subscription inside. And the idea was, if two children had these bears, and they were visiting each other, the bears communicated via IR and exchanged their phone numbers. And when the child took the bear home and would hug their bear, it would set up a call, send a message over the GSM system to the other bear, who would light up and send a greeting from the other person who was hugging the bear. It was a very, very neat idea. Now, you may laugh about that, but what's one of the big advantages of putting money inside toys, jewelry, etc.? Right, remember, this is virtual money. It's the ability to ask for the service later. Okay, how many of you will admit, okay, maybe you admit to you having brothers or sisters who get toys and they play with them for a little while and then they stick them in the corner and they forget about them. Okay, anyone who admit to that? Okay. Now, guess what happens to the value of the prepaid subscription that's sitting in that toy in the cupboard? No. It doesn't grow bigger. Right? There's no interest being gathered by that money. What happens? Yes? No, it's still there. The prepaid SIM card still has its subscription there. Yes, but only if they're used. These cards, the clever thing is to say, we're not going to set a date of expiry on it. We actually want the value to remain locked in that SIM card and be forgotten about. Yes? Yes, so it reduces the value of it. But the most important thing is it will be forgotten. No one is going to, many years later, pull the bear out, gut it, grab the SIM card, and stick it in their phone. Okay? So effectively, what the operator has been able to do is print money. Right? They took in money, they gave you, printed it digitally, put it in the SIM card, and in finance, there's a special word for this, but the advantage is that basically it gets forgotten, and you never have to provide service for it. And because it doesn't automatically age away, like Chiemsee region in Germany has a currency that ages, I think, at some percent per month, and it automatically, unless you top it up, the currency purposely deflates away to encourage people to spend quickly. This doesn't have any such timing mechanism. So again, operators love it, particularly if it's forgotten and you don't spend it, because then they don't have to provide service for it, but they got paid. And as I say, if it's forgotten, it's like printing money. Now, many customers actually like, if they use their device a lot, to top it up regularly so that there's plenty of prepaid amount in it. And there's a company in the UK some time ago that found that because of the large immigrant community in the UK who couldn't, because they didn't have credit, get regular phone service, but they could get prepaid service, the automatic transfers that people did to top up their accounts was the interest that was made by investing that money was the major source of profit for this telecom company. So the result is they priced their services extremely low. So the customers loved the services because they were low priced. But because everyone kept a positive balance in their prepaid system, yes, the operator was earning the money by just, yes, interest. A completely different approach to how you're going to make money, which is one of the interesting things in this business. GSM prepaid can either be kept in the SIM card or in the network. But when the balance goes to zero, the customer can only receive calls. And in fact, some operators won't even let the customer receive calls. And to refill, you can do various sorts of things. In Latin America, prepaid 81% of the market. So this is a very, very big factor. Now, there's some problems, however. And one of the problems is the fact of the difficulty about tariffs. So what are tariffs? Well, tariffs are the filings that the telecom operator makes with the government saying, here are the charges, right? We're going to charge 1 krona per minute during these hours. We're going to charge 0.5 krona per minute during these hours, et cetera, et cetera. And for international calls between Sweden and this place, we charge this amount, okay? And they file all of this. The problem is, yes, they're mobile phones. Okay, so what happens when I take my prepaid phone to another country? Anyone try doing that? In most cases, it doesn't work. Right, because the problem is it would need a whole new set of tables of how to charge for the calls that you make, because it's location dependent. The other problem, which is something that I had never understood the complexity of until I talked to some people at one of the operators, and that's the problem about taxation. Because it turns out taxation is location dependent. Yes, so not only do I have different rates, but I have to pay different rates on the taxes and to different authorities depending upon where the user is when they made that call. Yes, it gets very complex. Whereas what happens today, well, in the billing system, I have all of those as billing records. I have an entire group of hundreds of people who just keep up with the tariffs and the tax rates, and a giant computer computation sorts everything out and does it. Why is that a problem for prepaid? Well, the problem is, in most cases, all of that now has to be done in the phone. Right? If we don't do it in the phone, but we do it in the network, then we can do this full complex calculation. The problem is now we have lots of communication back and forth, and we'll see the big problem is enforcing this problem of when the balance goes to zero, cutting the customer off. In general, systems like to be able to do real-time metering because when the balance is zero, then zoop, there's no risk. However, if the operator takes some loss, then it turns out you can actually relax the real-time constraint and make the problem a lot simpler. And prepaid increases the complexity of the customer care. So for instance, you have to warn them in a timely fashion to say, hey, you need to put some more money in to top up your balance. So there are four basic alternatives for prepaid, one called the Wireless Intelligent Network, the service node, hot billing, and handset-based. The wireless intelligent node, basically what happens is you have a prepaid service center over here and then this intelligent peripheral that connects to the mobile switching center. And when calls happen, we consult this device. It looks in its database and it tells the switch, yes, allow the call to happen or no, don't let the call happen. When the call ends, it decrements the balance in the database, etc. And then, as if it weren't complicated enough, we add another twist. And that's the difference between the calling party pays versus the called party pays. In Europe and Taiwan, the calling party pays. If you place the call, you have to pay. However, in the US, it's the called party pays. You receive a call and you have to pay. And you have to pay for outgoing calls. And this having to pay for incoming calls means most people don't give out their cellular telephone number, right? Because if somebody gets a hold of it and they call you, you have to pay. This is a much simpler model here. And that difference complicates matters whenever the called party pays in the prepaid system, because we also have to debit the prepaid subscription when you receive a call. Another approach is the service node approach, and here it takes a rather interesting approach. It simply trunks the voice call through the service node, and the service node provides all the support of deciding whether the call should continue or not. And the advantage here is we remove the load off of the MSC. However, what's the cost? Well, we have to have two lines connecting to the MSC for every call that's in progress. This is good, of course, if you sell MSCs. But it's a problem. Another approach is hot billing. And hot billing is quite popular because basically what it does is it couples the prepaid center with the HLR authentication center. And so now when the call terminates, we generate the call data record, post it to the prepaid service center. And when calls are set up, of course, we always have to check the HLR AUC. And the result is the operator has the cost risk of only one call. Right? So it checks here at the beginning of the call and says, yes, the call can proceed. The customer has a positive balance. The problem is if they talk for 87 hours, they may run up a charge that when it hits the prepaid center, it says, that's right, the user's way over their balance, but it's too late because the call already completed. It turns out there's often a problem with this if the customer is allowed to set up multiple calls, because if they start the calls whenever they have a positive balance, of course, yes, they have credit, so let all these calls proceed. And one can go and read this details. So the result is increasingly that people don't like to use this approach. So we said the fourth model was the handset-based one. And this is relatively popular, and GSM actually includes something called an advice of charge message. And so now you can debit the balance stored in the SIM card itself. It builds upon the fact that we can send messages to the SIM card, and the SIM card keeps a number of values. The interesting thing is the fact that the accumulated call meter and the accumulated call meter maximum, the total amount of calling I can make, those are readable. But for prepaid cards, the access gets disabled at the time of the manufacturer by an SMS message when you subscribe to the prepaid service. So the result is that you can't alter these things anymore. There's still records, but too bad you can't alter them. And the operation is really straightforward because all of the charging now happens inside the SIM card. It authenticates itself. Now, a hard problem is those advice of charge messages get sent back to the handset, which is supposed to decrement the counter of the amount of money remaining left in the prepaid account. However, I said, it's a message coming back to the handset. What if the handset simply says, I can't hear you, and therefore throws the message away? It doesn't decrement the account, and wow, I have a prepaid account that just lasts forever. So what people have done is introduce a combination of hot billing with prepaid in the handset. So the result is I can basically look for fraud by detecting, does the amount of remaining balance in the SIM card compare with the amount of balance in my database in the hot billing system? If they don't, there's a problem. Now, unfortunately, the disagreement could actually be perfectly legitimate because of problems about synchronization between the two. But then, at least we minimize the number of cases where we have large exposure due to the hot billing. There are lots of problems with roaming and prepaid, and you can read all about it. And my favorite is the fact that the advice of calling message isn't encrypted and therefore can tamper with it. That, of course, means not only can you ignore it, but you can think about sending advice of call messages to someone's terminal. Yes, purposely, yes, billing them for calls that they didn't make. Now, if you spend much time around this business at all, you hear about something called ARPUs, and it doesn't mean something bad that someone did in a swimming pool. It's an average revenues per user. And as the numbers of users increased, a big problem was that, of course, the average revenue per customer decreased. Because the earlier customers were these business customers who spent lots of money. The people who are putting them into their stuffed bears aren't spending very much money. So it's clear that the average is going to decrease. But what are the average numbers like? Well, it turns out that if we look at numbers of customers, and this is the case from TeliaSonera's fourth quarter report, 2003, you can look up current numbers, prepaid users' average revenue per user was about 94 krona in the fourth quarter. Postpaid was 425 krona. So we see that these prepaid customers are spending less than a quarter of the amount of money of the postpaid customers on average. Here's the average amount, minutes of use. About a quarter of the amount of minutes per use, the average on the neighborhood in Sweden, about 129 minutes of use in the quarter versus Finland, 164 versus Norway, 167. And here's the relative prices. Does anyone know what the average number of minutes per use is in the country in South America which has the highest amount of minutes per use per month of any country in the world? Yes, what is it?
In my case, I use the phone all the time.
Yes? But do you know what the average per customer is?
I use 500.
Yes. So the result is, if I remember, it was 400 and something, nearly 500 minutes. So four times the average usage of these customers. And as she said, it means you have to be on the phone an awful lot of the time. And one of the reasons is, of course, for traffic. Another is, I think, actually the people just like to talk a lot and be sociable, etc. And so it's a cultural issue. But these are not insignificant amounts of money when you multiply this number times these numbers. We mentioned location-based services. One of the major uses has been navigation applications. How do I get to where I want to go to? Now, of course, you could think about using systems with GPS, and some handsets nowadays have GPS built in. But, as we'll see later, emergency services wanted to be able to also provide location-based services so that even if you can't speak, if you can dial 112, they can figure out roughly where you are and send the rescue people to get you. And so as a result, the U.S. government enacted the rule called E911 Phase 2 Automatic Location, which requires that the operator be able to identify something in the neighborhood of at least 80% of their customers, location to within an accuracy of 50 to 300 meters, 60% of the time. Now, why all these different percentages? Well, it turns out that there are some users it's very hard to locate. So we can't locate them. In others, if they're in very rural areas, we may not be able to locate them within 300 meters. We may only be able to locate them within a few kilometers. But in urban areas, typically, we can locate the customer very well. And that's good because lots of our customers are in those places. And this was a requirement by the operators. Yes? No. We can actually track the users because they send these updates about what base stations they can hear. And when they do that, they actually send signaling data, and so we have not only the list of base stations, so we know which base stations are around them, we know the signal strength to those base stations, And to the base stations that they report this to, we know their timing offset. And that's, of course, why if you don't want to be tracked, you actually have to turn the phone off. Because otherwise, it's sitting there sending this maintenance data into the network, whether you make a call or not. It would be nice to think that it was only if you made calls, but not true. There's even location-sensitive billing. So, for instance, KTH has an agreement with an operator that if you use your KTH phone on campus, it's billed at exactly the same price as if you made the call using a fixed telephone. But if you make the call from off campus, then you pay a higher price. So how do they know whether you're on campus or not? By, yes, they look at what cells you're using. Now, in return for getting this agreement, what did the cellular telephone company get besides a guaranteed payment of a certain amount of money each year? No, they got a payment each year. They put up cells on the campus, right? Because they need to cover the campus and know, aha, you're using it, you're in the cell. Other users who use these cells, yes, they don't get to pay these nice prices. They get billed as if it's a regular mobile call. All right? So sometimes it's not just the flows of money, it's also sometimes the virtual rent that would have to be paid for having a base station in the place. But location-sensitive billing is a very interesting area. And then location-based information. Where's the nearest restaurant? Where's the nearest gas station, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, for things like fleet tracking. How to determine location? We can do it passively based on cell identities. We can also do it based on satellite positions. And we can do it actively based on timing measurements, the time advance I mentioned, by time of arrival, time difference of arrival, enhance observed time differences, angles of arrival. But today, a very common approach is increasingly assisted GPS. Now, why not just GPS? Okay, any of you use a GPS receiver? Okay, so what happens when you use your GPS receiver and you go indoors? That's right, because it was not designed to be used indoors and the signals are too weak, so, gee, I have no idea where you are. Right? So what do you think assisted GPS takes advantage of? The last time I knew where you were, right? And I can tell which cell you're in, and I can tell how you got there, so I know roughly where you are. In addition, it provides the timing data so the GPS system can simply say, aha, this set of satellites should be visible. I don't have to go searching for satellites. So I can very quickly know my location. So I use signal strength and these various techniques indoors, and then I use GPS and I get quick fixes outdoors. Well, why don't I just keep GPS on all the time when I'm outdoors? The power consumption of keeping the receiver running would burn up my battery. That means I turn it off a lot. But if I turn it off when I wake up, it doesn't know what time it is, and therefore it can't solve the equations to figure out where it's located. But guess what the cellular system provides extremely accurately? Yes, the time. So the net result is I simply take the time from the network, look in my tables, boom, I know where the satellites are. Very neat. And of course, because it's assisted GPS, we get to charge the customers a little further. However, there's a problem about geographic locations and privacy. So there's an activity inside IETF called GeoPriv. How do you manage to provide geographic location to different people to different resolutions? So I might be willing to tell you this morning for the next half hour that my location is in Alba. But at 10:15, if you ask, where's Professor McGuire? I may want to only give you an answer that says, I'm in Kista, or I'm in Stockholm, or I'm in Sweden. right? Because you don't need to know where I am at 10:15. So, how do you manage to control the distribution of geographic data with different scopes and different resolutions to different consumers? And that's a problem. And you can read more about all of these things. All clear? Any questions? Okay, now we'll leap on to WAP, heterogeneous PCS, and 3G networks. Well, WAP, the Wireless Application Protocol, was basically trying to provide online services for mobile phones. Unfortunately, the companies involved, the usual criminals, suspects, Ericsson, Motorola, Nokia, the big players, said, hey, we want this to work for mobile phones. And they all believed that there was something special about mobile phones, right? Because they had small screens, they had limited amounts of power, they had very little computing power, et cetera, et cetera. So they, together with this company called OpenWare, formerly Unwired Planet, said, we need a special protocol stack to have in these phones because TCP/IP isn't good enough. Now, the WAP model says, therefore, that we need to encode the data between the special microbrowser that we will have, which will use a new markup language, not HTML, but instead WML, which of course is the WAP markup language, and we will send these special WAP encoded messages to the WAP gateway, which will automatically turn them into HTML, send them off to a normal HTML server, and if it gets HTML back, it will translate it back to WML, encode it, and send it to the terminal. Yes. As I say, their erroneous thoughts were terminals were limited in processing memory and display, communication channel was expensive, the operator was the natural intermediary in all communications, and we needed a special protocol stack. Now, why did the operator want to be the intermediary running this WAP gateway? Well, and their theory was that if we run this WAP gateway, that means all e-commerce and so forth has to go through us, so we'll just charge a little bit in every transaction, right? Because our customer in our network went out and wanted to buy this MP3 song or something like that from the server on the network. Hey, it's our network. We're going to charge them. Unfortunately, there's a problem because, of course, this operator was seeing all of your transactions, including your credit card numbers, et cetera, all in plain text. Because they had to be able to manipulate it, encoding and decoding it from WML. Do you really trust your cellular operator that much? You go to your bank. You went through, your cellular operator's WAP gateway to reach your bank. They saw all of your account balances, your PIN codes, all of these sorts of things. It was a disaster from a security point of view. It became an even bigger disaster when someone in France came forward and said, France Telecom is requiring me, if I am in France Telecom's network, the only WAP gateway I'm allowed to select is France Telecom's. Whereas in a number of other places, banks were putting up their own WAP gateways saying, hey, if you want to come to the bank's gateway, don't go to your telecom operator's bank gateway and show them your PIN codes. Come to another WAP gateway, go directly to our bank. We keep it all secure, nice and safe in the vault with your money. And fortunately, the courts in France said to France Telecom, no, it's an illegal monopoly. You cannot force all of your customers to go through your WAP gateway. But it was the first country to rule against an operator trying to force everyone through their gateway. And I'm very, very happy it was successful. Unfortunately, WAP has one perhaps interesting feature. And that's the ability to have push services. And in push services, the idea is that a server attached to the network can send content to the mobile without the user requesting it. And the reason why this turns out to be so important is back to that problem about NAT. Because the problem is that these users in here didn't have globally reachable addresses, so there was no way to have a service out here that would send the user something. So the user always had to connect through to the service, which, as we saw earlier, is inefficient for synchronization and other reasons. So WAP in the first go-round introduced a WAP stack. It didn't really provide end-to-end service because you had to have this gateway in the middle. And they, as I refer to it, they WAPified SSL. So they said, SSL, no, we're going to make it better and make it suit WAP. We'll just make a few little changes. Unfortunately, it turns out every single change that they made reduced the security of it. Most operators use SMS to carry WAP. Well, what's the problem there? Well, we saw it's expensive and had big delay problems. So not only was the security horrible, but the performance sucked, right? And even worse, lots of terminals had their own software and every different type of terminal, and each different device, of course, had its own resolution, its own size, and so content had to be prepared differently for every different terminal. Utter nightmare, right? So anyone trying to provide content had a very difficult job. They had to say, okay, how many of our customers have an Ericsson, blah, blah, how many of them have a Nokia ESA, et cetera, and figure out which of all of these things they were going to support. WAP 2.0, of course, you always get it better the second time, is now actually just a TCP/IP stack with HTTP, normal TLS, normal TCP, and, of course, for backward compatibility, they still support the optimized or WAPified stack. And the advantage now in this model is you have a direct connection to the HTTP server. There's no WAP gateway required anymore, so you can have good security. Unfortunately, it took them a little while to do that. Anyhow, you can go and read about these protocols if you want. So I say one of the most important things really that was emphasized was WAP push, being able to send content whether you ask for it or not. Skip ahead, heterogeneous PCSs. We said yesterday one of the hard problems is there isn't one network. There isn't one technology that's successful, so somehow we have to deal with the fact that we're going to have multiple families of radios, and we somehow have to make it all work together. And of course, the advantage is some of them provide increased capacity or increased coverage or decreased power consumption or increased bandwidth or decreased delay, etc. So we end up in a situation where we can have similar radio technologies with the same network technology, so we use the same network management and mobility protocols, but for example, we use cells that have low power levels in the midst of other cells that have high power levels. And this is extremely common when you have, for instance, a large meeting, a big political meeting in a location. What does the operator do? They bring in a bunch of low-powered microcells, set them up, interconnect them. Why? Because this increases their capacity, right? That's the great thing about a cellular network is if you split the cells into small pieces, you can increase capacity. The next thing that you can do is you can say, well, you can use different bands. So for example, we might have 900 megahertz GSM system with this big cell and GSM at 1800 megahertz having the smaller cell. Why? Anyone who studies radio systems? Well, the advantage is 900 megahertz has, for a given amount of power, larger propagation area than 1800, so we can take advantage of the difference in the propagation characteristics to naturally give us a smaller cell. But note, it's the same or similar radio technology, but with the same network technology. Now we can think about taking different radio technologies but keep the same network technology. So in the case of both using IS-41 for the mobility, there's a combination between IS-136 and AMPS and IS-95, which was CDMA and AMPS. This was the analog telephony system. So we could combine those. We can also take different radio technologies and different network technologies. So for instance, GSM DECT, which we talked about yesterday. So the next problem becomes one of tier handoff. How do we switch from one cell to the other? Well, for the same radios or similar radios, same network, it's really very simple. It's just a normal handshake as usual. In the case of different bands, it gets a little more complex because the radio has to now be able to listen to more than one frequency at the same time, but still, because it has the same network technology, it's easy. And then, of course, it gets increasingly hard. And in the different radios, different networks, the easiest thing is to just simply set up a new call, perhaps with automatic redial. And we talked about yesterday that for GSM. That was okay for when we had a call in place. What do we do about registration? Where do we register? Which of these tiers, the small cell or the big cell, where do we go? Well, in the case of different radios, different networks, the goal is we may actually have to either register in multiple places or to find a new multi-tier HLR that simply integrates the HLR of the two different systems. Right? So then we only have to register once. And the advantage is we can now have single registration. And that reduces the amount of registration traffic and actually decreases the time needed for handoffs because we're already registered. And then, of course, we have the problem in a call, which is which register do we go to when we actually need to deliver a call? All right. We said yesterday there was a difference between user identities and the identities of the mobile terminals. We can either have a single identity or multiple identities because now we've got, of course, multiple radios actually using different technologies. Do we have a single identity or not? And do we have single or multiple mobile stations? Because, in fact, these might be integrated in one device or might be several devices. We still want to treat that user, the subscriber, as one entity. They should only have to register once. And then what do you do with services like streaming? So I had a student a couple years ago who looked at the problem of, okay, I have this mobile handset. I walk into the lab. I've got a nice set of speakers there. I'm listening to the streaming audio. What do I want to do? I want to hand the audio over to this other system seamlessly, right? So the music is just played there. And if I'm watching a little video and now I have this nice big display, what do I want? I want it to automatically be able to migrate over to that display. With voice over IP technology, it's relatively straightforward to do. But in traditional mobile networks, it's been very hard to do. What are the forces deriving the adoption of heterogeneous networks? Well, in most cases, it wasn't because people said, yeah, I want to run all these different kinds of networks. No, it's because of mergers. So when AT&T acquired Macaw, the problem was, yes, the other company used a different technology. Bell Atlantic merged with 9X, and yes, they used two different technologies. Vodafone merged with AirTouch. Yes, they used two different technologies. And my favorite, Deutsche Telekom's T-Mobile, when it took over VoiceStream, not only got, yes, a different technology, but they also got all of the wireless LAN operations of Mobilestar. So they had three different kinds of networks, and they really wanted to be able to run one network, to have one subscriber be able to use any of the networks. So how can we internet these various different systems? Well, you can use loose coupling or open coupling, really no integration except combined billing. Loose coupling where we have a single subscriber database, we now can use centralized billing, and we allow internetworking by using IP to connect the different networks. We can use tight coupling where we actually integrate the radios into one single core network. And we can add very tight coupling. In this case, now the interworking connects the radio access network, and we simply add a new interface, and we make, for instance, wireless LAN access points look just as if they were radio cell in our regular network, in our regular radio network. The big paradigm shift is we're moving from voice-centric services to data-centric services, and therefore from circuit switch to packet switch, but there's some problems, particularly for QoS, and what do we do with streaming media? And we've got a continually evolving set of terminals and applications, and most importantly, a change in the expectation of users. What do I expect to be able to get as a service? Another problem is what are the expectations of the operator? So in the past, of course, the operator expected that you are going to have to stream all of your content over their network. But as we increase the amount of storage in the device, do you need to stream? I mean, my wife's MP3 player, she has, I think, every CD that she owns. So is there a need to stream that content in real time to a handset? No. So the whole market is gone. Oops. And that's the basis for much of the demand for third generation networks, which is you are going to have to provide high bandwidths to stream lots of content to the user. So when we return this afternoon, we'll talk about 3G networks. Any questions? If not, have a good lunch. See you at 1 o'clock.
Thank you.